Digitizing Biodiversity Literature for the World, today on the Library Channel. Welcome to part two of Digitizing Biodiversity Literature for the World. Kathy Norton wraps up her discussion of the Biodiversity Heritage Library's digital projects, and Phil Konomos provides an overview of the ASU Library's digital initiatives.
These are currently all of our collaborators, the Internet Archive, the ICZN, Open Content Alliance, and those are the open access principles, or as they kept saying, honest to God, yesterday I was at the workshop here for the taxonomists, and every single one of them got up and they said, well, we follow all these principles, but if you don't like them, I've got more. Quoted, and they were quoting Groucho Marx. So I decided, well, I got to put that in here. You know, the Open Content Alliance with their open access, but they don't change. They really are for open access and all of these other, you know, places. So this is the biodiversity portal, and unfortunately is still that long, biodiversitylibrary.org, and it serves the images, it creates. This is the different part. This is not just the book. What we're doing in the portal to align ourselves with the EOL is we're creating the volume, the part, the piece, the metadata, ingesting it right down to the page level, okay, and attaching GUIs. Because when you are looking for a species and you bring something up on EOL, you don't want to be pointed to a 400-page book to go look through. You want to go right to the page. You want to go right to the page. So that's the informatics work that we're working on to make sure that we bring you right to the page where it was first described or what it's referred to, okay? So that's a little different than just pure Google scanning where, you know, you want the book, there it is, where you have no idea what the hell is inside. Okay. So the Internet Archive Scribe, this is what it looks like. There are a couple of cameras up here, and you know, the person sits in this chair, the glass plate comes up and pushes down on the book, they take the picture, and they do all the skewing there. I mean, I've seen this in operation, and I think that the people who are trained to do all the scanning, they're amazing. They are. They really love making sure that everything comes out right. The quality is really terrific. I take that back. I've seen a couple, but most of the quality of the book is perfect. There's never anything off. They skew everything. They can, you know, globally do that at the end if they find that the whole book kind of got, you know, 1 or 2 degrees off of being scanned. Then it gets sent. You know, from any of these stations, either here or in London, it gets sent to the Internet Archive to be OCR'd and marked up and quality control. So this is all of our mock-up language, but I haven't even got to name bank, so I'm not going to talk about that. So the biodiversity informatics part of the program, are you bored? Are you dying? It's hot. Jesus, what are you doing to me? It's 400 degrees in here. Ah, okay. I know. So in biodiversity informatics, I just say that the explosive growth is just beginning. In India, they started a Center for Biodiversity Informatics. They had an event in 2004, Ocean Biodiversity Informatics. Conferences have been going on. Species-based sites were developed, fish-based, ant-based, amphibian web, North American mammals. I mean, it goes on and on and on, and they are all standalone. So the encyclopedia is trying to bring these all together. Specimen-based networks, regional networks, OBIS, we're very involved in that because that's the ocean, ocean biodiversity information systems, the geomancers, identity life. Oh my God, it just goes on and on and on. Edit. This guy, Vince Smith, who's creating Edit, who's doing a fabulous job. And they now have a biological informatics degree at the University of Illinois in Masters. So this thing is really taking off. So And you know all this. Da 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 da. Okay. You know that. Okay, so what we're doing here is people talk about Web 2.0, which is really getting boring, but we have lots of tools that we put in that are going to use some of the foundations of Web 2.0. Each site is going to have several different components. The species page is for the general public. Draft pages, we'll be using the mashup technologies, and the draft authenticated pages for the experts or the curators will use wikis. So the information is going to be protected from being changed by anyone except the curators, but anyone can add comments or you can examine what's being suggested. We do have a lot of curators who have signed up to be in charge of that site. I mean, the spider guy, you know, the ant guy. You have to have someone who's going to curate those pages. So that's what we're trying to do now. Each site is going to have a community assembled space, taxonomists, molecular biologists, bird watchers, those kinds of people. Each link is different, and they're going to have different databases and information. And we're going to definitely focus on the social networks that are out there because, as we like to say, the spider freaks, the leech aficionados, polar bear lovers, ginkgo groupies, and microbe mavens, or whatever. In the early days of natural history and natural science, it was those people that were out in the field all the time that they knew more about it. I heard a talk last night of Norm Platnick, who is at the American Museum of Natural History, and he's a spider guy. I mean, he's a big deal spider guy. He knows everything there is to know about spiders. And what he always says, don't go ick. Because if you go ick, you will just keep in mind that you'd be dead because the spiders eat all the insects. And if they didn't eat the insects would eat all the food and you'd be dead. You'd have nothing to eat. Okay, Norm. But Norm has created something that is absolutely spectacular. He's created a database, obviously, with lots of information about spiders. But he now has this image recognition tool so that if you're in the field and you see this new spider, with the black or the green or the red or the don't go ick. You can take a picture of that, upload it to its database, and it goes through all the pattern recognition and will either tell you whether you have a new find that you can name or it'll say it is, you know, arachno blah blah. So lots of these things going on out there. Each group network controls the information in its space. So scientists working on aging wanted access to longevity information in the EOL. I'm going to talk about that a little bit later because I'm really excited about that. So they've proposed to organize a community around finding that information on aging and longevity in some of the species pages and set up their own portal to get at this. So a school wishes to catalog the biodiversity of a site near their schoolyard. They'll be able to use these BioBlitz tools that are being developed and take pictures, put them on the site, combine software in their community. And then they'll be able to load these kinds of things. You do a checklist of all the organisms that you find in your area and you put it back up onto the web page. Now this gets me to my favorite part, if I haven't put you all to sleep. This is all about names, and accumulated information of a species is tied to a scientific name, a name that serves as a link between what's been learned in the past and what we know today and what can be added in the future to this body of knowledge. So who knoweth not the name knoweth not the subject, Linnaeus? Oh my God, he was amazing. So information about name groups and organisms, it extends back hundreds and thousands of years. There are books, journals, surveys. There's museum species and herbarium. There's everything out there about these animals. And the challenge for contemporary digital libraries is to find that information. Who is it? Ken. Yo, bluefish capital of the world, right? Okay. So that's where he's from originally. The bluefish capital of the world in Connecticut. Bluefish, scientific name in the 1800s was Chromis epicurus, then it became Pomatoma saltator, Pomatoma saltatrix, and Temnodon saltator, okay? Now, come on, who can remember that? If you want to find this information in the, I've got out there, I'm scanning all these books for you, baby, but if you don't know the names of the fish, how are you going to get all the information that's out there? So you have to homogenize this, you have to put it in a hierarchy so that you can track all of these names. I love this. So the names are the only universal metadata in biology. Names annotate data objects. A compilation of all names used is the foundation of a universal index for biology and for the semantic web. So names really offer the only logical way to search for things. Why does this matter? Why does anybody care? Well, for publishers, museums, libraries, federal agencies, it becomes really important to know that the name of this little newt down here, this Nophthalmus viridescent, he's used in regeneration. I mean, this poor guy, they're cutting off his arms all the time. This is a medical research model, and it's used in regeneration. But there's plenty of information about this little model that's very old, but it had a different name. Taxonomists change names over time for valid reasons, but they don't track them. So we have to find a way to track all these name changes. So PubMed has about 474 of these, and JSTOR has about 672 articles but they don't track them. So if you are looking in JSTOR for Nophthalmus viridescens, you'd get 281. But look how many are under Demetricus viridescens. You know, there are 280. You wouldn't find any of those. So unless you track the changes, you're not gonna do anything. Serious challenges in our environment nowadays. You have one organism, four scientific names. You're gonna pull up four different maps. You will find four different maps if you don't track those names to each other. This is the red rose sea anemone. And my poor little redneck partridge. Look how many names this guy has. Plus all of the names that are in, we call it vernacular, the common names. You have to be able to search in the common names. Taxonomists hate to use common names, but we're libraries. We have to link these because that's how people look at it. And if you look at Google and if you look at, you know, things like FishBase and you see, you study how people search. Even the people in the scientific field are now beginning to use more and more vernacular names, even though the scientists don't put them in their papers. So you have to link those names to them also. So at the MBL, about 5 or 6 years ago, we decided that what we needed to do was build the Universal Biological Indexer and Organizer, because we needed to put in one place all the names that are out there in the library and link them back to each other. So our motto is reuse, don't rebuild. You know, we had to find a naming algorithm that would seek out all the scientific names in old texts and put them in one place called NameBank. So this is the beginning of UBIO, the Universal Biological Indexer and Organizer, and this is how the library gets so involved in this. Someone called us one day and said, you have nothing on bluefish. And we said, of course we have something on bluefish. We're a marine biology laboratory. Well, there's nothing on your website. Well, the name had freaking changed. The name had changed, and this scientist was using the new name. So everything that we had in the databases, you know, he couldn't find. He didn't know all the old names. So you said, you know, well, this is crazy. So what we need to do is have a place, an indexer and organizer. We put all the names in one place. We'll link them so that all you have to do is run through that one database and grab it. If you're searching for bluefish, come to this database. It will give you the 17 scientific names and the 38, you know, common names. And then it will go out and do the search in JSTOR or PubMed or wherever it is. And so we started to build that. The Mellon Foundation thought it was such a good idea that they gave us $1 million to create this UBIO. And right now we have almost 11 million names in there. So We talk about this as the taxonomic intelligence. This is linking things back and forth to each other. So we created a name bank, and then to satisfy the taxonomists, who are truly a cranky bunch of people, we create a classification bank. Because they use classifications, we use names, that's how we retrieve the stuff, but they use their classifications. They don't want to use your classification if they don't agree with it. So we put in there, you know, all the different classifications. So you can go in and search by a classification if you wish, okay? So we reconciled all the alternative names. We tried to disambiguate most of the similar names. We exploit the hierarchies. And we have merged all the various data points and names so that you end up getting one map for specimen data. So these are the two guys that I had working for me, David Remsen and Patrick Leary, who were the brains behind this whole thing, and they did such a fabulous job. David now is over in Denmark as the head of informatics at GBIF, the Global Biodiversity, and Patrick is leading up the informatics team for the Encyclopedia of Life. So it's a growth industry, guys. UBio, 1.7 million names and name strings. We reconcile the groups. That's the website. And this is, you know, basically this is the algorithm of going out. It's real easy to write an algorithm for finding scientific names. They're binomials, so they're in Latin. They're usually italicized. They're two. One starts with a capital and the second one doesn't. So you run, you know, you run this search through them and you take all the names out and throw them in. And you will find some ambiguous names and you will find some non-names like Anorexis nervosa. We don't want that. I mean, that's not a species. That's something we don't, I don't have. Okay, and then, you know, it gets trained and it gets improved and it learns not to recognize some names. So we also have the taxonomic intelligent RSS feeds. Basically what they do is they come to UBio. And for us, this is how we adapted the RSS feeds. We use 200 animals in Woods Hole in research. We have 10.7 million names. There are 1.8 million animals. We only work on 200. So what I do every day, we set these RSS feeds to go out and search for those 200 animals only, all right? And it brings back those results. And for anybody inside the MBL, obviously it can search all the Elsevier journals, the Springer journals, anything that we have access to. But we've also put in there some good blogs, we've put in newspapers, we've put in anything, news articles, science from the New York Times and things like that, so that people get the latest and they're constantly kept up to date. And you can search over here, as you see over here, when it brings it back, you again can search by using this hierarchy and this taxonomy to, if you just wanted to find something in, I don't know, herbaria or something, you know, one of the hydrozoas, that's all you'd get. This is our web page that we're, you know, we change it every 6 months, but this here is our author publications. Every week we search the literature to see what our guys in Woods Hole are publishing in, and we put it on the front page. We put it on this website, you know, they all want to be on the front page. So we go out and we search and we get them all on the front page and put them there. And you know what, if we miss them, they call us up and say, you didn't get my paper, put me up. Okay, fine. So that gives us a way, it's a two-edged sword for us. That gives us a way to know what they're doing in Woods Hole, okay? We immediately send them an email saying, congratulations, you've just published in a gold journal, so we've downloaded your paper and put it in the institutional repository. You just published in a green journal, we've waited 6 months, or you published in a black journal and you've got to, you know, write your ways. So we write to them all the time so that we can at least get what they're doing and put it in our local repository. Now, the only reason I, you know, brought this up is that on the same page, we do the same thing for Woods Hole, you see over on this side is the author publication. On this side is the species publications. We troll the RSS feeds every day for what's being published on those 200 species that they work on to make sure that they're up to date on what's out there. So they can go and look at themselves and they can go look at their favorite animal. So these are some of the little things that we've implemented in the library that come out of these great big projects. Taxonomic intelligence, scientific parsing. Basically, I won't do this because it takes a little bit of time, but what happens to a book when it gets into our into the Missouri Botanical Garden, into the portal, what we do is we go through every single one of the pages using that algorithm to pull out every single one of the scientific names. And by the time you're finished, what you find is that it adds about 20,000 synonyms to the names, so that your retrieval rate just increased by like 500%. Okay? Most of these books, remember that you're scanning, are 1923. 1% of the names change every year. So think about it. We're almost 100 years later. The odds of you knowing the name of the animal, how it was referred to in 1923 or before, are no longer good. So you have to run it through these parsing things and then find it. So what happens here is this is a plate from the Biodiversity Heritage Library. And down here, it shows you that it's run through UBio and it gives you the names. All right? Over here, this page has a lot of names on it. It gives you the back names and anything that refers to these animals. So you can get at it. Again, going through, you can search our database by using these clouds, the Google clouds. So taxonomic intelligence is a lexicon of scientific names. It has reconciliation and disambiguation. It has hierarchies. It's integrated into information retrieval, and it links to other data types like molecular, morphological, and phenotype data. And so this is beyond. This is in my daughter's backyard. She has in her backyard a cranberry bog. Isn't that nice? I put that in there too. I knew you'd like that. So this is EMF, it's the Ellison Medical Foundation. They were at the lab last summer, some of the people who work, and when we were talking about this, they said, wow, that's amazing. How about linking that data to the Biology of Aging project that we have going on? So we said, okay, we'd like to do that. So we wrote a grant in like a week. It was 3 pages, and we got $2 million to do this for 2 years. So I had to go out and hire people. You think I know about this stuff? Oh, the genes? Get out of here. So here what we have. We have to figure out the genes, the organisms, the locations, and the conditions, put it all together in a Fedora Commons, you know, umbrella, just like we do with the BHL, and talk about how the longevity, the aging genes will translate across into the organisms and their life cycle. So what are we using in the Ellison Medical Foundation grant? We, of course, have downloaded all of Medline, which took a week, GenBank, EOL, the habitat and location information, as that all comes in, that's all going to be put into this database. What we understand is all organisms are affected by aging. Not all aging is associated with disease. On the flip side of that is understanding aging might give insights into regeneration, and that's the medical foundation part of it, okay? So they want to understand aging and regeneration. The biomedical focus is to expand the scope of organisms beyond the classic models that are used. So these are the questions that we're asking in year 1 and 2 of this proposal. What genes are associated with the aging condition? We actually know that. There are 359 of them now. And that's, what is this, March? We started in January. What are the conditions associated with the genes? What organisms are associated with the aging genes? What other organisms might also have aging genes? Where do the identified organisms live and in what habitats? And this is where the Encyclopedia of Life becomes very important to us. What are the demographic patterns and what are the common phenotypes associated with this? So you can see that these are all questions. What's come out of scanning all the material, knowing what we're going to do with the Encyclopedia of Life. Here's another group that comes in from the sideline and said, hey, wait a minute, all that information you have, we now can possibly answer some of these questions. So this is a library. This is a library project. Even though we don't have all of these molecular biologists on our staff, the work that has to be done is library work. That's all it is. It's library work. I like that too. Sorry, I put it up. That's Gesna. It's one of our sea monsters. Now, this is, if you haven't had a chance, please go look at the Encyclopedia of Life. It's really in its rudimentary stages. We only have up about 30,000 pages on fish and maybe 25 exemplar pages. But it's going to be there. A lot of people involved in this. The Mellon Foundation started it, the Sloan Foundation, the MacArthur Foundation, the Internet Archive. A lot of people working on all of these projects. And I put this in here because I think the importance of data and the new things that are happening on the web are pretty spectacular for people to look at. This is something that was put together that just shows you how people are using data on the nets. Okay, these are flight patterns. So you're watching data points, okay, that are being transformed into what I now refer to as the new internet art. That's the United States. And those are the flight patterns. Those are the data points of planes. I find this fascinating. I don't know why. Without geography, landmarks and patterns emerge. You don't even need geography to see the East Coast waking up, going to the West Coast, going to Hawaii. Look at that. See how the whole United States wakes up. I just find these things so fascinating that people are taking just these data points and doing so many creative things with them. There's a young man named Jonathan Harris. I met him last year. He's about 22 or 23 years old. And if you have a chance, I can't remember, but if you Google Jonathan Harris, he creates these absolutely unbelievable things on the net about blogs. He tracks people's emotion. He reads blogs, automatically reads blogs. I feel good, I feel bad. And he makes these wonderful color designs out of them. And then you can search about, you know, age demographics. Who between 20 and 30 feels really good or bad or, you know, yucky or whatever. And the stuff is absolutely beautiful. So there's a whole new thing happening out there of internet art. Did I ever think in the Encyclopedia of Life that the Ellison Foundation would come and say, hey, you know, let's see if we can meld these two things together. So we're looking for all these other linkages to happen around the Encyclopedia of Life.
How the animals are feeling, for example.
How the animals are feeling. Dr. Doolittle, that's what we need. I'm done.
Well, when Dan asked me to say a few words, I have to admit, I thought my few words were, ladies and gentlemen, this is Kathy Norton, and then he came back and said, no, unfortunately, that's not your few words. And then he said, and by the way, you're going to follow Kathy. And if that wasn't depressing enough, he said, oh, and it's going to be podcast, so you can't make anything up. So I'm going to try to work through this really fast and just kind of give you an idea of what we're doing. First of all, Kathy, I think I can speak for all my colleagues here when I say I hope someday the words "we just received a $25 million grant" will roll off our tongues as easy as it has rolled off yours. So,
just make it easy.
So, you know, one of the things that really it's interesting, and I mean, all the stuff that we have needs to go someplace. And one of the questions that people ask me all the time is, why do we need that repository? Why can't we do what we've been doing? Why can't, every time we need something, why can't we just put up a web page? Well, as of the summer of 2007, the ASU libraries had something like over 12,000 web pages. Some of them were 10 years old. People that had created them have come and gone. You know, you really can't search across web pages. So about 3 years ago, we decided that we would create a repository. So I'm going to go through this fast because over the next coming months, we're going to spend more time, the people in ICS and also in Bibliographic and Metadata Services, talking about not only why we've decided to work on a digital repository, but how this is progressing. But one of the things that we felt in creating a digital repository, there's three things that would improve the library digital services, that would provide a greater digital accessibility, and to take advantage of the new technologies. And first, let me kind of put this into, I always consider myself the lowest common denominator. So let me put it, what we're talking about is we've got all this information. And what the repository is, it's a box. And we're going to put everything in the box. And that way, we'll know where it's all at. Now, there are a number of boxes out there. There's DSpace, there's ContentDM, and we chose Fedora as our box. The problem with Fedora, there's a lot of great things about it, but the problem is there's no real easy way to get stuff in the box. And there's no easy way to get it out or to index it. So the last couple of years, when you've seen that we've been hiring digital library software engineers, and what we've been doing is creating a workflow to move our holdings into the Fedora database and to move them out and to index them. And that's what we've been working on. There's a lot of things here, but on our development, the one thing that I want to really point out here as we move through it is we want to provide greater digital accessibility. There's a lot of things we can say about it, but that's really a main goal. The gateway to the Fedora repository is what we call the ASU KnowledgeNet. Currently, we are in alpha, and I mean we're in alpha. But if you'd like to go into it and look at it, you can see it at k.asu.edu. And you can play around with it. You can look at it. The most important thing is if there's anything you want to tell us about it, there's anything that you like about it or dislike about it or any thing that can help us, send a note to MIMO. MIMO, raise your hand. MIMO is taking all those. MIMO's been going across the university, talking with professors, talking with research people, talking with students, talking with librarians to help us build an indexing model. There are a number of things that, you know, the service benefits, but they increase the discovery of, again, the digital resources we have, and that's what we're really looking for. And this is a mock-up of what, if you go to KNET right now, you'll see. And one of the reasons why we liked Fedora is it allows us to put a lot of different things in it. I mean, we can go with the images, audios, videos, maps, publications, archives and special collection materials, finding aids. So, it handles these really well. This is a mock-up. If you go in and look for either GIS or maps, it'll bring you back this page. It'll allow you to go in and look at it. At the top or is our ASU Maps collection. Beyond that is the a link to the Institute for Social Science Research. And I might take this plug right now to introduce Mary Whalen, our geospatial data manager, who just came to work today and will be. And I when I saw this thing with the airlines, I turned to her and I said, I want that. One of the other things we've started to do is the publications from the faculty. We go through and when new publications come out, we put them in the Knowledge Net. One of the cool things that a lot of you probably don't know, but on the ASU directory, the first thing UTO goes and looks at before they, as they're putting together directory, is they go to KNET and they look at what publications have come out there. So again, we're starting to add. We're concentrating currently on the faculty in biodesign. We have a relationship with them and we're working on that. This is a oral history. This is a photo from an oral history project that we worked on with the Arizona Jewish Historical Foundation and Archives and Special Collections. And we were talking about this yesterday. One of the big things in research now is relationships. It's not enough to just be able to say, this article was written by this person, and there you have it. What people want to know now is the relationships. Okay, he wrote or she wrote this article, but who were their co-writers? What is the relationship to different institutes, organizations, the co-authors? What is their relationship to an institution or a co-writer? And if you go into the Knowledge Net and look on it and put to biodesign, it'll bring a huge list of faculty members. You can click on any one of those and you can see on relationship. And what this is, it's a flash kind of program, and it's really nice. It comes up in bubbles. On this is actually the biodesign. It tells you the different areas of biodesign, the relationship. Then the W is the website. You can see back here George Post. The D is the director. You can go on George Post and then see all the relationships there. It's really nice. One of the challenges we have is when it's about that size, it's really great. But if you get a person who's got like 500 articles, it kind of is one big bubble and it's hard to go. But we're working on that. Of course, we have the library. We'll put the library channel in there. And this is the homepage for the library channel. We will put stuff from special collections. This actually is a project that we worked on a few years ago, the Western Waters Digital Library, which is a part of the GWILA grant that we did. And our part was the Central Arizona Project Collection. And then we have relationships with other groups, and the Embryo Project is the one that Kathy was meeting with the Embryo people yesterday, and Jane Manshine will come at the end of the month and talk to us. And I know she'll be talking about not only the project, but the library's part of the project. We started working with them a little over a year ago, and they're using the Fedora repository as their repository, and the workflows that we've created for them are workflows that we're also using for ourselves. And this, they just went live with their site 3 weeks ago, and they're in a massive trying to populate it. I understand that from Kathy, they have thousands and thousands of photos that she's going to give them to scan or just may link to them. And of course, a couple of years ago, we worked with the School of Music on an LSTA grant in recording graduate students, and we will have those in the repository. This is what the page looks like. If you go, this Breakdown Tango. Now, I don't know Breakdown Tango, but I hear that if you ask Christopher Marins, he will hum it for you. But you may want to wait till afterwards. We're working with the graduate college on electronic theses and dissertations. We're hoping in the spring of 2009 that students will have an option to submit their theses and dissertations directly to the library electronically. This is a mock-up of what that would look like. We have a relationship with the Museum of Anthropology, and these are thumbnails. You can click on the thumbnails, and they expand into larger pictures. And we're hoping to, I think, Matt, how many of these do we have right now? Lots.
Yeah,
okay. And then ArchiVision. ArchiVision is an electronic database that we have. It's mostly used in architecture. What's nice about it is it's a database, and you can create a front end to it on your own. And we hope to also provide a home for the database in the repository, and to be able to pull out slides that the professors can use. Currently, the 16,000 slides are what were provided to us from the electronic database. Professors use them for their classes. What we hope to expand that, you saw 100,000, we hope to let professors ingest their slides into the repository. And what they do is when they have a class, they can come right to the repository, take the slides they need, and have it for their class. We have currently the Morrison Institute, which is a think tank, Arizona think tank here on campus. That Arizona State houses, their publications are in the repository, and they use the repository to pull this out from their homepage. And what we do, we still have a lot of work to do. We're currently finishing up our workflow, getting things into it, getting things out of it. We're working on an indexing process. And our hope is sometime in the spring to actually get into beta, and then by the end of the year we'll be getting into full production. Like I said, we're looking forward in the next few months to have sessions with everyone and start to tell you a little more about our repository. But that's it. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to Digitizing Biodiversity Literature for the World on the Library Channel.